Subscribe to our free podcasts at abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson. This is Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. Ahead today, success on Macquarie Island. It's taken 2 years, but rabbits, rats and mice have been eradicated. It's all been done with the help of specially trained pest hunting dogs. I'll be joined a little later by one of the dog handlers who has just returned from the sub-Antarctic island. Also ahead, calls for the federal government to make sure Indigenous Australia is included in plans to develop the north of the country. We'll be taking a look at the current impediments to greatest Indigenous employment and opportunity and discussing how that can be overcome. That's all coming up today on Bush Telegraph. All of Australia's university veterinary science courses are changing the way that they teach animal welfare and ethics. The universities say it's in response to the Australian community's growing interest and engagement in animal welfare issues. Earlier I spoke with Professor Paul McGreevy, who's from the Faculty of Veterinary Science at the University of Sydney. Paul's also been one of the leading proponents of this change, and I asked him what's being done differently.
Well, what we've achieved is approval for a major project with approval from the Office of Learning and Teaching, which is a federal office, and they've agreed to fund this web portal for veterinary students to learn about current animal welfare issues and to develop ethically informed approaches to various topics and ethical dilemmas that they'll encounter in practice.
Welfare and ethics would surely be taught already in vet courses, wouldn't it?
It's there, Cam, but I think we've got an opportunity here to make sure that the coverage is as good as possible. We're really looking at world best practice here, and we've got some tremendous leaders in animal welfare science across the Australasian vet schools, but they have their own specialty. So we might have a professor from Melbourne who's particularly strong on cattle welfare, and we might have somebody in Sydney who's got a focus on horses. So this is a chance to ensure that the very best teaching innovations are pooled by all of the Australasian vet schools.
So is it fair to say at the moment, if you're a student, your view on ethics or the information you're exposed to will depend very much on which university you attend?
That's right, yes. Each school has its own strengths, and that would be reflected in the way it delivers its animal welfare and ethics teaching.
Why is there really a need for this, though? Why do you need a national approach that draws on everyone's expertise and makes it available to all students?
Well, I think the recent debates within Australia have certainly demonstrated that animal welfare and ethics are of growing interest to the Australian community, and the Australian community in turn looks to veterinarians as the informed guardians of animals and animal welfare. So vet schools increasingly need to address these issues if their graduates are to be in a position to help their clients and industries respond to the broader community's concerns.
What types of ethical dilemmas or welfare questions would a working vet face?
Well, what we've charged ourselves here with in this project is thinking about a day one graduate, because of course one day they're not qualified to practice and then the very next day they are. So we appreciate the importance of preparing our students for that very important day one. And the sort of ethical dilemma you might encounter in practice could involve an animal that you see on a property that hasn't been presented for veterinary care, and that creates a number of ethical dilemmas, including how you protect the interests of the client, but how paramount you make the welfare of the animal.
So this
another
is...
example might be if you're asked by a client to destroy a companion animal that's perfectly healthy. That's an example of what we call objectionable euthanasia.
So in veterinary science, the interests of the client and the interest of the animal don't always they don't always go hand in hand.
Well, that's right. Yes, and I think this is highlighted in the UK oath that veterinarians take when they become members of the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons. That oath makes it very clear that the person taking the oath is going to accept the challenge and commit to prioritising the welfare of the animals in their care. Other oaths around the world are less specific, and it's a very interesting area that we get into when we start comparing the oaths that these veterinary professionals take on graduation.
How big a change is this to the way that vet science is taught in Australia and the focus, the emphasis that's put on the ethical and the welfare component?
I think this is a significant change, because it's not often that we get such enormous support from a federal source for teaching innovation in the veterinary curricula. So we've got an opportunity to make an enormous difference here. And the wonderful thing is that all of the Australasian vet schools are on board. And we had our first meeting last week on Thursday and Friday, and all of the leaders in this discipline were flown in to Sydney. And the goodwill around the table was tangible. We made enormous strides in just our first meeting, and this is a two-year project, so we're very excited.
Are there some that are opposed to this, though? Some in the industry, working in the industry, or some in the teaching, the education side of the industry, that think a vet's role is really about serving the interests of the client, coming in, treating a sick animal, and then moving on to the next job?
Well, we haven't encountered any objections or any obstacles. I think every veterinarian realises that their first responsibility is to look after themselves, and if there are veterinary ethical dilemmas out there, they can compromise not just your job satisfaction, but also your quality of life. So we're aware that unfortunately our profession is plagued by high suicide rates, and anything that provides our new graduates with an ethical framework that allows them to tackle those dilemmas has got to be good.
You're hearing from Professor Paul McGreevy from the Faculty of Science at the University of Sydney. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN. We're discussing the fact that the way veterinary science courses teach animal welfare and ethics is changing. There's a nationally consistent approach being put in place, and it's all about adjusting, if you like, to the fact that more and more Australians are engaged in this debate around animal welfare and how we should treat animals in this country. Also with me is Rosemary Elliott. Now, Rosemary was a founding member of a group called Sentient. It was formed back in 2011 by trained vets, and its role, I guess, is to lobby and debate issues around animal welfare and ethics, but from a vet science point of view. Rosemary, thank you for joining Bush Telegraph.
Thank you, Cameron.
What are your thoughts on this change to the way vet science is taught in Australia?
Oh, look, I'm really excited about it. And thank you for the opportunity to sort of share in you know, announcing this and discussing it. It's very, very progressive, a very progressive step for veterinary education in Australasia, I should say. Firstly, I have to admit I'm a graduate of the Sydney Uni Vet Faculty, so it's really lovely for me to see, you know, that they've received this federal funding and they're going to be taking a sort of a leadership role in setting the criteria, the curriculum. That's very exciting, personally. But from the point of view of the reason why we set up Sentient, I think this is very exciting because it addresses some of the barriers that we've experienced to improving animal welfare awareness in the veterinary profession. And as Paul says, the public expects vets to be leaders in this or to take a leadership role. But if vets don't see themselves as being equipped to do that, then they can't. They're actually letting the profession down, in a sense, the face of the profession. Because it is a very highly regarded profession. It's a very trusted profession. What we think, or what we've encountered, and I certainly found this as a student and after graduating, is that there are still some vets that hold fairly stereotyped views about the animal welfare movement. And also, they're not consistently receiving the sort of training that, say, I would have received at Sydney Uni in animal welfare science, where you're given that ethical framework to apply. So without that, they're sort of quite lost when they're confronted with ethical dilemmas.
But isn't protecting or enhancing animal welfare, and in the process addressing some of these ethical questions, isn't that just inherent in what veterinarians actually do?
Yes, it is, but it has its limitations. It's inherent because vets all do take an oath, and you know, their prime reason for going into vet science in many cases is to relieve animal suffering, and that's obviously addressing animal welfare. Freedom from pain and suffering is one of the five freedoms. So yes, vets do address animal welfare on a daily basis through doing that, and I think they're often quite sort of unsung heroes. So part of our role in setting up Sentient was to promote what the profession is already doing, but because societal attitudes are shifting, people are aware of welfare problems in all forms of animal use. Now that would include things in production animals like sow stalls, battery cages for layer hens, live animal export, etc. And people are expecting to see vets advocate for the welfare of those animals. Now, the issue for vets is that they're often placed in a position where they're faced with a conflict of interest. So there's a perceived pressure from employers or from industry to conform to the prevailing views and standards of animal treatment, which are often just historical, and they aren't driven by vets. They're driven by, well, tradition. In many ways. And these are at odds with what vets will regard as best practice in animal welfare.
But why is it the role of vets to move into this domain? Isn't that why we have policymakers and regulators to make these choices and these decisions and these rules around what the public wants, and then the vets operate within that framework?
Well, I mean, I agree with what you said earlier, Cameron, is that it's part of an inherent role of vet science to address animal welfare. And I think vets have a lot of expertise in this and should actually be part of that policy, informing the policy making and the decision making, not being sort of passive recipients and saying, OK, well, this is what the industry code is. I mean, vets have always commented, but, I mean, this we're getting into tricky area here, but to some extent, the vets who comment are not independent vets. They're often employed by industry or somehow employed by government. What we need is more independent commentary using animal welfare science and an ethical framework as the basis for that commentary. And so vets can actually play a role, because really vets are either performing these procedures or kind of tacitly approving of them. And I'm talking about things like invasive procedures, often performed by farmers where animals are not receiving analgesia. Now, we would never do that with any companion animals. We wouldn't do that with other sentient beings. They have the same nervous system. So as vets, we can't really stand by and say, well, that's okay, you can do that to a pig, but you can't do it to a dog.
Mm. So what do you think is the real value then in the fact that all the major universities have got together for a national approach to teaching questions around welfare and ethics?
I think the value there is that vets will all receive consistent training across vet schools, and within each school the animal welfare and ethics will be part of the entire curriculum in every subject. I think that will be very empowering. Firstly, it'll give them skills, there'll be the critical thinking, the communication, the problem solving, and it will also actually empower them to believe that they should be taking a leading role in setting standards of animal care, and rather than adapting their practice to the expectations of other stakeholders such as industry.
Rosemary Elliott is one of the founding members of Sentient. It was formed by vets back in 2011 to be more vocal around animal welfare issues from a vet science point of view. Also with me is Professor Paul McGreevy from the Faculty of Veterinary Science at the University of Sydney, and we're discussing the fact that the all eight universities across Australia and New Zealand that teach vet science are introducing a new national model, a new national curriculum around animal welfare and animal ethics. Paul, will this curriculum go right into the realms of what is the correct use of animals? Will it question whether animals should be used for human consumption or companion animals or for medical research? Does it go to that level of detail, that level of questioning?
Well, it will certainly look at the different ethical frameworks that can be used to justify animals and compare different philosophical approaches to see how students can align with one or another. But it's certainly not a one-size-fits-all approach. There are two important things to point out. We're not going to impose anything on the students. We're going to give them the tools for them to make up their own minds. And equally, this project is a pooling of resources. It's not going to impose a one-size-fits-all approach on all of the vet schools. It's going to give them a wealth of riches from which to choose, and so they can use the resources that we developed to deliver the intended learning outcomes that they're committed to for accreditation. But there's still a lot of flexibility, so different schools can use these tools in different ways.
Is it a fair comparison to say this moves vet science closer to the questions and the issues that are discussed around medical science, the ethical questions that are taught there?
Oh, it's more than fair to say that, Cam. You're on the ball there. Medical ethics are a truly established part of the medical curriculum. Some medical schools give 60 hours face-to-face teaching on medical ethics, and we're very pleased that one of our core team, is a veterinarian who works within a Centre for Values, Ethics and Law in Medicine. That's Dr. Chris Dedgling, who's been on this project from the start. So he bridges that that gap, if you will, between the veterinary profession and the medical profession. So we're uniquely placed to play catch-up here and climb on the shoulders of what's been achieved in the medical profession.
Okay, so you've got money. You've already started meeting as a collective group to come up with this. When will it actually be happening, be taught in Australian vet schools?
Well, we'll be integrating parts of this project as early as next year, but the project runs until this time, 2016.
All right, Paul, it's an interesting development. Thank you for joining us and telling us all about it.
Thanks, Cam.
Professor Paul McGreevy from the University of Sydney, Faculty of Vet Science. And Rosemary, thank you for your views today as well. Been nice chatting with you.
Thank you, you too.
Rosemary Elliott is one of the founding members of a group called Sentient. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Coming up next, we'll get today's Rural News. Tony Allen's been following this morning's rural news developments. Tony, the trade deal with Japan, it's still getting a lot of reaction. Fruit growers have had a bit to say this morning. What are you hearing?
Yes, well, I did mention yesterday that one of the big winners from this could be SPC because tariffs will be eliminated to Japan from canned tomatoes, peaches and pears under the arrangement. However, SPC has issued a statement saying that the free trade agreement is a good thing, but it's not going to send canned fruit to Japan unless the Aussie dollar drops by another 10 US cents. It's still not viable because the market for canned fruit in Asia is very much dominated by China, and they undercut us. But the news is good for those who supply fresh fruit. And John Wilson from Fruit Growers Victoria says there are new varieties of red blushed pears developed in Victoria's Goulburn Valley that they think will be very profitable exports. And so it's looking good, but still some of the stuff that we grow is not quite what Japan wants.
The major peach market for processed fruit in Japan is a white peach, which is simply not grown in Australia. So there are issues around what benefit we will get directly from it. But importantly, if the tariff wall comes down on fruit and the Australian dollar is in the right position, it's a very good market for our high-quality fruit.
I'm not sure I've ever had a red blush pear. Have you tried one?
Yes, yes.
Any good?
Oh, they taste like all the other pears, but they look very nice.
Yeah, okay. I believe Japan's got a real taste for Australian cherries, if they are big, particularly if they are big. So are we going to send more big cherries to Japan?
Well, not if they're affected by little cherry virus. Now, this virus was detected fairly recently in several orchards in Tasmania, and the virus pretty much says what it does. It produces smaller than normal cherries, so they can't really be picked or marketed. The virus... Overseas, there are insects or some sort of vector that spreads this disease, but in Australia, that vector's not here. So the only way you can get the virus here is from grafting trees from disease rootstock. Now, they have found out that some cherries came from overseas, United States, I think. And the trees were distributed by two nurseries in Victoria, and they could be all over Australia. Thousands of cherry trees in all states could be affected by this disease. Simon Bowie from Cherry Growers Australia says the extent of the virus in orchards across Australia should be known by the end of this week, and they're checking it out quite seriously.
Once the decisions have been made and the decisions whether it can be eradicated or can't be eradicated, then we need to ensure that growers are given as much information as they can in relation to possibly, you know, testing or having testing done for the disease, looking at identification and also management of the trees, so whether to get rid of the trees, the ways to get rid of the trees and also replanting.
That could cost a fortune.
Yeah, I was going to say, nervous week then for Australia's cherry industry. That's quite a big story. A lot of rain falling around the country in the last few days, last day or so. What have you heard?
Well, if you look at the weather map for Australia, there's this whopping great band of rain that goes pretty much from the Kimberley right down through central Australia, across South Australia and across Victoria and into a bit of Tasmania and southern New South Wales. And this is absolutely perfect for grain growers who've been pretty much in drought.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, the autumn break, they need rain now so that they can plant round about Anzac Day, and some might have planted seeds a little bit earlier anyway. So great news for the grain growers. Also for the Central Australian cattle stations, some of them were on the verge of being declared in drought in Central Australia, but now there's a flood advice warning for the western Alice Springs district. Rain is falling east of Alice Springs as well, and the dust is turning to mud. The rivers are flowing,
mm-hmm.
so it's probably pretty spectacular. And for the cattle stations, they were pretty much close to having to flog off their cattle cheaply because they couldn't feed them. But Angus McKay from Umbeera Station says they're going to keep off the roads now and keep their cattle for a longer period.
We were ready to start cattle work this week. That'll be all off now for at least a month or 6 weeks. We've just got time on our side. Now, the cattle are still going to be sold, but the markets are only going to improve slightly, and with the rain over in Queensland, New South Wales, it can only get better.
Okay. So there's some rain in Central Australia. I was doing some research on Twitter to find out if the Todd River is flowing, and at Caddy Brain has sent us through a picture. And there is a flow there, but there's debate as to whether it constitutes a flow because some locals say it's stormwater. So if you're there, because they have the saying there, if you see three flows, you'll never leave. So no one's quite sure if this counts as one or not.
Well, there is more rain coming. One of the most spectacular sights you can ever see, and I have seen it, is rain coming off Uluru.
Yes, I'm lucky enough to see that.
Waterfalls,
well.
It's magic.
Brilliant, isn't it? All right, Tony, we'll leave it there. Tony Allen with today's Rural News. If you want to see that picture of the Todd River sort of flowing, it's at our Facebook page, facebook.com/bushtelegraph, and also on the Twitter feed. We've just retweeted it at RN Bushtelly.
The world's biggest democracy is voting now, but will religion divide the Indian people? The frontrunner says there's only one religion, India first, only one holy text, the Constitution. But when he condemns the slaughter of sacred cows, is it just anti-Muslim code? Meanwhile, the country's top imam says Muslims shouldn't back the Hindu nationalists. India's electoral minefield. That's here on RN this afternoon at 5:30.
Cameron Wilson with you. This is Bush Telegraph. Stay with us. Very soon we head south, a long way south, in fact. Macquarie Island, looking at the successful, or it's being claimed, a successful pest eradication program on Macquarie Island. So that's coming up soon. But first, the other end of Australia, the far north. Advocates for better Indigenous training and development programs are urging the federal government not to forget Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in the planning to develop Australia's north. Places like the Northern Territory, there almost one in three people are Indigenous, and this is a young and a growing population. You would have heard there's a federal inquiry underway at the moment. It's looking at how best to promote development in Northern Australia. And one group that will appear before that inquiry is the not-for-profit company called Ninty One. Managing Director of Ninty One is Jan Ferguson, and she told me earlier that the inquiry needs to think imaginatively and realistically about Indigenous people when they look at development in the north.
Well, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are such a significant component of the population in that part of the world. To use the Northern Territory as an example, 30% of people in the Northern Territory are of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander descent. So if you're going to really develop something and do a fabulous job of it, you can't do it without a third of the population being involved.
But what are the characteristics of that population that make it critical that it's involved in development?
Well, over half of that population in the Northern Australia is under 24. And so if we are looking at developing, you know, we're talking about things that are not going to happen, you know, really kick in until well after I'm retired, for example, you're looking at that next generation needing to participate. And with half of that population under 24, we need to be making sure that we're creating interesting and worthwhile lives for those young people.
I see your submission says more than half the population in Northern Australia could be Indigenous by 2050. Where does that figure come from?
Well, it's extrapolating the statistics. Whilst ABS does a fabulous job, the statistics on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders can be a bit fraught. But if half of them at the moment are under 24, it's logical that as they grow older, you know, they will have families and that population will grow. In some places, it's already at that that level. If you go to more regionalised statistics, 60% of Cape York is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, 50% of the Kimberley. So as you can see, those populations are in the majority Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander now. As that young cohort comes on, has families, you can reasonably expect that that will grow.
But that would include considering places like Cairns, Karratha, Darwin, Townsville as Northern Australian towns?
It's a huge piece of land. It's about five times the size of France, the sort of land that you're talking about when you use a term like Northern Australia in the context of this development.
Mm.
And it's sort of a line, it's the Tropic of Capricorn is the line that gets used, and it's a bit above Queensland, Gladstone in Queensland, and below Newman in Western Australia. So as you can see, it's quite a sizeable chunk of the mainland.
Yeah, is that the line you go by though when you talk about these statistics? Are you pretty much saying everything above, roughly above the line of the Tropic of Capricorn?
We've done the best we can with the statistics to come up with what we're talking about. Ninty in its work talks about remote Australia, so we work with the whole of remote Australia and don't use the Tropic of Capricorn as an arbitrary line. But in the context of this particular development, that is what's being used, with the exception of the territory where it's not terribly far above Alice Springs, and so people are arguing that Alice Springs should be incorporated in the development.
At the moment, what do you believe is holding back greater Indigenous participation in the general economy at the moment?
Well, look, we're not sure. We're doing a whole lot of research on this at the moment, so without wanting to preempt any of that, we have done some work on understanding the education levels, because that's one of the things that people say is holding back Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander positioning in the real economy. Well, we've just recently had a look at that, and some of that doesn't quite add up, because there's a couple of things that get said. There's no jobs in remote Australia, or people don't have the education to get them, and we've done a piece of work unpacking the census, and we think there's about 50,000 jobs in remote Australia, which is, quite a number. We have looked at the education level of those jobs, and 41% of all of those people had not gone above Year 10. So you're looking at people who don't necessarily have a high-level education getting those jobs. So we need to understand further why Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people don't get those jobs.
Is Year 10 level education common amongst Indigenous Australia?
And more. A lot of Aboriginal people are qualified way beyond Year 10 and have, certificate level qualifications, and, they're quite a highly trained group of people. But for reasons that we don't understand at the minute, they're not reflected in these employment numbers.
So something's going on that's not education based.
Well, we don't think it is, based on our work of unpacking the census, and we're about to question and have a look at human resource practices and just see whether they work for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who everybody knows want to and should be able to continue to engage actively in their culture. So we might need to look at some more creative ways of engaging.
But formal education, I guess, is only one measure of suitability for employment, isn't it? You've got remote people, Indigenous or otherwise, that don't have the same access to, say, technology that might be expected for suitable employment these days.
And look, that's something that we also, with a series of other partners, work on, is making the point that we really need broadband to be universal in the bush. There's some studies in South Africa that have shown that the employment outcomes of people in remote parts of South Africa went up by figures as high as 20% when they had access to mobile networks and smartphones. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't work too these days too well without my smartphone. And yet I work out bush a lot and I don't have access to my smartphone out there. So it's certainly much more convenient for me to do all the things I need to do when my smartphone works. But we don't have that in Australia, and you don't have to go terribly far out of bigger centres before you have no coverage for your phone.
So is your argument, if these types of issues are holding back Indigenous employment at the moment in Northern Australia, then there's no reason to think they won't also hold back opportunities for Indigenous Australians once this greater development that's being planned is realised?
And that's why we've put into our submission some things that are not entirely about the development of agriculture and the things that people normally think of when they think of these kind of submissions. We've put in some other things that we would believe are facilitating issues to actually achieve what's a great vision. And if we're going to achieve it, then we need to look at things holistically and actually really have a good conversation about what level of broadband coverage are we going to have in these places so that these people have the same access to employment as people who have access to all the technology.
You use this term desert syndrome, I see, in the submission. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, we did a piece of work some years ago where we looked at the qualities of everything that lived in the bush, and we did this in co-funded research with Land and Water Australia, and we looked at things like plants and animals and people and anything generally, and did a whole lot of modelling. And what we found is that there are several characteristics that if you don't take account of them, things don't work, and they are issues like climate variability. You know, it can be freezing cold in the middle of winter and, you know, very hot in summer. You have widespread low and patchy primary productivity, so your productivity can be intensified in some places and, you know, not that high in others. You have sparse and mobile patchy populations, so we have people congregated in centres and then not much in between. They're distant from anything in the desert, is distant from markets and decision making, and you have a whole lot of social variability amongst the people who live there. So those characteristics actually, if you are working in an area, you need to take account of them. Like, if you're going to do something and you're going to build a road, well, you need to take account of the significant rainfall that will happen at times. Mm-hmm. Won't always be there, but when it does, it'll rain buckets, and you need to deal with that. That's the sort of example of what I'm talking about.
So factors that on their own might seem like small issues, but if you group them all together can have a considerable cumulative impact.
That's absolutely right. And if you, like, one of the other ways we describe this is if you don't bring critical mass to some of these problems under this desert syndrome idea, things will fail. So if you put in a particular initiative which reduces critical mass, we would argue out there it will fail. You've got to think about those sorts of things. And critical mass can be, you know, moving people out of a district to some other place to do something somewhere else. That will have a fundamental impact on the fabric of some of these communities.
To bring this right back to the plans to develop Northern Australia that's being assessed by the federal government at the moment and what this means for Indigenous Australians, surely including Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians in the development is a question of social justice and equality and desirable, but is it necessary? Surely it can be argued that agriculture, tourism, a health industry, the types of things that are being raised, these things can go ahead even if the Indigenous population is still marginalised?
We don't believe you will be ultimately successful because you will always be dealing with pockets of communities that are, you know, very dysfunctional. So you can, if you don't actually engage people in, you know, a better standard of living and the like, you will always have those issues that come with poverty. And so we need to be working towards eradicating those sorts of things by really good, strong, you know, engaging developments. Otherwise we will have the development but won't have achieved what it set out to achieve, which is to improve the standard of living of people who live there and, you know, overall the gross domestic product of Australia.
Do you feel this imperative for inclusive development is being discussed and addressed at the moment? There's a sense that a lot of the talk is about big agricultural projects or resource projects, but not so much about the social inclusion that might be necessary?
Look, I think it's a little early to tell, but what I would say is that the Parliamentary Select Committee that has been designated to look at this is certainly out on the ground listening to a lot of people. So they have a very active schedule. They're coming to see us in Alice Springs and a whole series of other stakeholders. It's a very active schedule, and I think that they couldn't help but be touched by the presentations that they're getting all over Australia and the level of submissions that they got. So I think they are actively engaging in what people on the ground think, and that's very welcome.
Well, I guess you get your chance to say it in person next month when the committee comes to Alice Springs. Jan, thanks very much for joining Bush Telegraph.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We've had an impromptu debate, I guess, today. The debate seems to be, does the current stormwater flow down the Todd River in Alice Springs count as a genuine Todd flow? This matters because the local mantra in Alice is, if you see three flows, you will never leave. We've got the picture up on at RN Bush Telly on our Twitter feed and also on our Facebook page. The Light in Life is definitive here. The Light in Life says, no, not if it's stormwater. Doesn't count. If you've got a view, you can find us on Twitter or on Facebook. There's almost no part of Australia's territory that's escaped the destruction of invasive species. But way down in the subantarctic, on an island that is 1,500 kilometres from Tasmania, the curse of invasive pests appears to have been vanquished. Keith Springer is the Macquarie Island Pest Eradication Project Manager. Keith, welcome to Bush Telly.
Good morning, Cameron.
Is the job done? Have you been successful?
We believe we have, yes.
How do you know?
We've had teams on the island for the last 3 years and searching intensively for any sign of remaining rabbits, rats or mice. And the last 2 years, we've not found any sign of them. And given the coverage we've been able to get on the island, we're pretty confident that means they're gone.
Why was it so important that you got rid of these pest species?
One quick reason is that the island is listed as a World Heritage Site, and with that recognition comes a responsibility to manage the island for its World Heritage values. And those were being compromised, I guess, by the impacts of invasive species. So that was an initial reason to act. But also, without the World Heritage listing, it's a nature reserve as part of Tasmania. And again, the rabbits and rats in particular were having pretty significant impacts on the island. So it was a sort of management responsibility, ultimately.
What are the impacts? What sort of things do they do?
Rabbits were existing in their tens of thousands. We think there were somewhere around 150,000 rabbits on average, and they were chewing through the vegetation at such a rate that there was very little left. A lot of the hillsides were completely denuded. We were getting increasing frequency of landslips as a result of vegetation removal, and some of the seabird species were being impacted too. With rats, the impacts were more around their predating seabird eggs and chicks in particular, and most of there's no trees there, so everything has to nest either in the ground or on the ground, so they're easy
prey
for rats.
Yeah, absolutely. How did these pests get there in the first place? Because this is a fairly remote part of the world we're discussing.
It is. It's 1,500 kilometres from Hobart and about 1,000 kilometres from New Zealand. But that's probably, the rabbits got there in 1879. They were introduced from New Zealand as a food source for the gangs of guys working on boiling up penguins and seals for their oil. Quite an industry in those days. And rats and mice probably got there accidentally introduced via Australia from ships, stores or shipwrecks on the island.
Okay, so they've been established there for quite some time. No penguin boiling industry on the island these days. Are there many people there permanently, though?
The Antarctic Division maintain a station there, and there's probably around about 14 or 15 people there through the winter and in the summer, with a few more programs active, then it can be between 35 and 40 people on the island.
Okay, but you've got a bit of space to yourself if you're there.
Indeed.
Yeah. What was actually involved, or how did you go about the eradication?
We did a lot of homework. It took about 3 years to do the planning that we wanted. We leaned heavily on previous island pest eradications and picked up the techniques and lessons learned and applied those to the Macquarie situation. So there was a lot involved in that, but the nuts and bolts of it involved an aerial backdrop using helicopters. We had four helicopters down there for the winter of 2011, and they spread a rodenticide, if you like, from buckets slung underneath the helicopters. That was expected to remove all of the rats and all of the mice, which it seems to have done successfully, and nearly all the rabbits, but we expected a few survivors, and then we planned for a hunting phase to track down those survivors and remove them.
And that's where the dogs come in?
That's where the dogs came in.
Okay, well, one of the dog handlers who's been down there is Karen Andrew, who's, as I say, a dog handler just back on mainland Tassie. Karen, welcome back.
Hi, Cameron.
How long was your stint on Macquarie Island?
Just over 2 years.
So you haven't been back in 2 years?
No, it was two consecutive years. So I arrived in April 2012.
Okay, what's the island like? Can you describe it for us?
It's really wild and beautiful. It's just crammed full of wildlife. There's so many penguins and seals and... It's quite difficult to describe it, really. Very windy and misty quite often, but and lots of rocky shores. It's really, really beautiful place.
Yeah, I was going to say, I take it you enjoyed the scenery if you went back twice. what were you doing down there? What did your job entail?
So I was one of the dog handlers on the project. I was out in the field for all but 4 days every month, just scouring the island with my dogs, looking for any traces of rabbits.
There must have been some days you wished you were inside rather than out in the field, surely.
There was the odd day that, you know, when your hands are really cold and you've just been caught in a hail shower and, you know, it's raining and you're wet and, then you would probably be quite happy to be indoors, but we usually tried to work the weather as much as we could and, you know, take advantage of any weather opportunities that were there and all the bad weather days, really looking back, no matter how cold and wet you were at the time, it makes for a good story later and always pretty happy to be back in the hut.
So most of the time, just you and the dogs out and about, was it?
So we work with the other handlers and hunters work together occasionally as well. But there is a lot of time where you're just out there with your dogs and, sometimes don't see another person for a few weeks. Other times you might see work with another three or four people. It just sort of depends.
So you have to like your own company, or at least the company of your dog.
Yeah, you do. I've seen more of my dog in the last, or my dog Finn, in the last 2 years than I have of any other person. We make a good team.
Yeah, okay. Where do you stay when you're out and about? Is it a case of camping?
No. So it's pretty good accommodation, really. There's a lot of AAD field huts across the island. And we've also got some water tanks that were brought in and converted into accommodation, just especially for the MyPEP eradication project. So they're pretty compact little water tanks. They've just a couple of bunks and a heater and a stove and cooktop. But very well stocked with food and reasonably warm and always pretty welcoming to go back to at the end of the day.
Yeah, okay. What was Finn's role? What actually was Finn doing?
So Finn was using his nose to look for any sign of rabbits around. So obviously we can look as hard as we can with our eyesight, but you're not always going to see, the sign of a rabbit peeing or, running through. And the dogs are just always on the ball and they can smell a rabbit from quite a fair distance away. So they just really increase our ability to find any sign that's out there.
But you work together. You use your eyes and Finn uses the sense of smell.
Yeah, it's a good sort of partnership, and also, you know, I'm using my brain and my knowledge of where rabbits are to sort of direct him into different areas. So, you know, getting him to search in between rock stacks and using the wind as much as possible while working him to, just increase his ability to smell. So obviously if we're sort of downwind of an area, he's got more chance of... Yeah, scenting out a rabbit.
But they are skills, like fin skills are particular to this kind of work?
Yep. So these dogs were trained to especially detect rabbits. That's their target scent.
You need to make sure they don't want to chase penguins and other wildlife, I imagine.
Yeah, so part of their training originally before they even came down to Macquarie was pretty well focused on not being interested in non-target species. So that was a definite focus for us. And the dogs are great. You know, they'll walk down the beach and we've got more problems with the penguins chasing the dogs than we've ever had with the dogs chasing the penguins. The dogs would just wander down and not even totally oblivious to the fact the penguins are even there. And these penguins will come chasing after the dogs. It's quite a
They're interested,
funny
are they,
sight.
The penguins?
Especially the king penguins. They're very interested in the dogs. I've had the dog in a sit stay and turn her back to turn around again, and they're just completely surrounded by these inquisitive penguins just coming to see what we're up to.
So they don't have any sense that the penguins, I mean, they don't have any sense that they're under threat at all?
No, they're pretty inquisitive.
Mm. what breeds Finn?
He's a yellow Labrador.
Okay. Why are yellow Labradors suited to this?
Oh, well, we've also got some Springer Spaniels as well. So we sort of had 50-50 Labradors and Springer Spaniels.
Mm-hmm.
The Labradors tend to be more plodders. You know, they're very methodical, and the Springers tend to be far more fast-paced and more suited to, you know, dashing up and down rock stacks and covering a lot more ground. They're very different sort of working
but
types.
They're known for their sense of smell, aren't they? I know they're used in the truffle growers use them to hunt down truffles.
Yeah. Labradors are a pretty common breed for working dogs. They're just quite easy to train. They've got a really great temperament and, just their size as well. And they're just really quite heavy duty. They just put up with everything that's thrown at them, and they really cope with the conditions, the cold and wet, very well.
So you're fairly... Well, you didn't see a rabbit, so are you confident you didn't miss anything?
I'm very confident. I've done around 6,000 kilometres walking on that island in the last 2 years and covered pretty much every square inch of that place, me and Finn, so I'm really confident that there's nothing there.
Okay. Keith Springer is also with me, who's the manager of the Macquarie Island Pest Eradication Project. Keith, what's it meant, this success? What's it meant for the wildlife on the island? Have you seen recovery already?
We have, Cameron. One of the most dramatic visually in terms of response is the vegetation started to recover within a few months of the completion of the baiting program in 2011. And initially that was, it was just a green tinge starting to come back to the brown hillsides. But over the last couple of summers, we've seen a lot of the tussock and the mega herbs growing, the Macquarie Island cabbage and the silverleaf daisy.
Mm.
So we've seen really promising recovery in those species. Interestingly, we've had botanists on the island this last summer and the previous summer, and using their sort of longer-term knowledge of the island, they're seeing a lot of maybe more cryptic plant species that are growing back in places that they've never been recorded before. So removing the impact of rabbit grazing seems to have been a real plus already for the vegetation.
The benefits are there to see almost instantly by the sound of it. I take it this is just the start of what will be a much longer recovery, though.
Exactly, and we, you know, the general view is that it might take 20 or 30 years before the island is sort of starting to reach a new equilibrium in the absence of rabbits, and even longer in some places where those landslips have come down and need longer to heal.
Does the success you've had on Macquarie Island, are there lessons for any other eradication attempts or projects from the experiences there?
Yeah, I think there are, and much the same way as we got a lot of mileage, if you like, from the experience of projects before us, in particular Campbell Island, south of New Zealand. But there are other islands that are trying to attempt this sort of thing, or in fact are attempting this sort of thing, and we've been able to help them share a lot of the planning work that we've done, some of the operational experiences and lessons that we've learned. So Lord Howe Island is one where rodent eradication is currently being considered, and there's some lessons for them, I think, although different location, different set of circumstances there.
But I take it there wouldn't be too many places that can claim this sort of success?
Not on the scale, Cameron, no. This one's the largest worldwide where anybody's attempted to get rid of rabbits and mice and ship rats either, for that matter.
Mm. So, Karen, what for you and Finn now? You're out of work.
Not quite. I'm quite lucky I get to have another stint working with Finn again in another month or so's time.
Just to make sure.
No. On another island eradication project based off the coast of Chile. So, it's just a short-term contract, but I'm quite looking forward to being able to work him again in another island and a little bit warmer conditions this time.
Wow, you and Finn travel the world, hey? Hunting mice and rats and rabbits. What an incredible job. Karen, all the best with the next trip to Chile, and thanks for telling us all about your experience today. Karen Andrew, who's a dog handler, just back on Tassie after being on Macquarie Island. And Keith, nice chatting to you as well. All the best for the future.
Thanks, Cameron.
Keith Springer is the Macquarie Island Pest Eradication Project Manager. And good to have a good news pest eradication story. That's Bush Telly for today. I'll see you at the same time tomorrow. In the meantime, at RN Bush Telly on Twitter and facebook.com/bushtelegraph. If you want to stay in touch, you can also find us via the RN webpage. Just look under program guide. Next is news that will be followed by The World Today.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. The people of Bulga in the Hunter Valley have just won a second court victory against mining giant Rio Tinto. The coal mine expansion that would have swallowed the village cannot proceed. Oh, except that the state government has changed the planning scheme to give more weight to economic factors. And a new planning proposal was lodged last week. The battle for Bulga, it's not over yet. That's on The Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, and you can download or stream this program from the RN website.